And you're listening to Homegrown Radio NJ.com. I'm Delia Quigley. This is Building Organic Bodies, and that's what we're attempting to do here on a Sunday night on Homegrown Radio. And I have with me Dr. Carolyn Dean and Bob Neverett, my co-host for this crazy show. Hey, good evening, y'all.
Good evening, Delia.
Good evening, Delia.
How are you this evening?
Well prepared.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, so Dr. Dean, our traveling activist, out whooping some butt around the world.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
What do you have to report?
I was up there in Canada, standing before the Health Standing Committee and telling them where they were messing up in terms of dietary supplements. So here's the scenario. I was up there on a witness day to show my support for our Bill C-420 up in Canada. Bill C-420 will put dietary supplements from a drug category back to a food category. They were put under a drug category in January of 2004 to everyone's great surprise, and it really angered most of us activists. So there was a witness day because there's been so much debate about this bill. And I was there with Dr. Abram Hoffer, who's the most famous Canadian doctor who started orthomolecular medicine with Linus Pauling. And at 84, he's still going strong and still sees patients and treats them for schizophrenia with high doses of vitamins. So Abram Hoffer was there. Andrew Saul was there. He is one of the editors for the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine. And some two health activists were there. So we must have said, between the five of us, at least 100 times that dietary supplements were safe. We were supposed to be speaking to about 16 members of the four different parties in Canada. Well, only four of them were there because the others were out protesting the government because they had failed to resign when they lost a vote of non-competence that day. So the four Liberal members there, two of them were working their BlackBerries constantly and not paying any attention. And by the end of our hour, two of them had left. So we were just talking to a few secretaries in the walls. That will all go on report, though. It'll be reported and transcribed so that people can look at it afterward. But it just showed me how, you know, close to hopeless it is to influence government.
So it doesn't sound like a very productive meeting there, Carolyn.
Well, I learned a lot. I mean, I learned that it's not possible to influence government. So what we're going to be doing with Friends of Freedom and Friends of Freedom International is like everybody else, going more legal, just going to court with our grievances. But I did have some very interesting meetings. There was also the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine, as I mentioned, along with the International Society for Orthomolecular Medicine. I spoke at the 34th annual international conference called Nutritional Medicine Today, and my topic was death by modern medicine. And actually, I should say, I did get to mention my book, Death by Modern Medicine, and the paper I worked on, Death by Medicine, in Parliament. So that's on the parliamentary record.
There you go. Yeah. Well, here we have, you know, between the two of us, you have Death by Modern Medicine, and I have empowering your life with meditation. So we have the flip side of the coin there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, well, welcome back. And you're off to Rome pretty soon for the Codex Conference, right?
Yes, that's in July. I have to scare up some money to do that, though. So that's my job for June, is to get funding to go to the Codex meeting in July, when all heck is going to break loose.
So you're needing donations?
Sure am.
All right, so there are people out in the listening world that were sending Dr. Carolyn Dean to Rome to represent you in maintaining your freedom to to keep, take responsibility for your health. So how much can they send you?
Well, they can send through Friends of Freedom International. Go to actually go to friendsoffreedom.org and see the numbers there, see the where to join and where to donate, and earmark it for Codex for Rome. That's that's what we need, because it is health freedom, but it's specifically on our dietary supplements for this meeting, where they've come to the end of a 7 or 8 year process where they've moved steadily toward a low potency vitamin and mineral allotment for world trade purposes. And what that'll end up doing is creating that low quality, low potency for vitamin and mineral companies that want to trade internationally. If you have a high quality supplement, another country could say, well, that high quality supplement is a barrier to the trade of our low quality supplement, and you must abide by the rules of trade standards. So with this, with world trade harmonization, when it comes to dietary supplements, we see the harm as being foremost.
All right, so go ahead and send your donations. And if you have any questions for Dr. Dean about her trip or where she's been, what she's doing, or anything that you're hearing on the show tonight, you can email us at live, L-I-V-E, at buildingorganicbodies.com, and we'll be picking up those emails so we can answer you during the show. All right, thanks. So let's jump over to Bob Neverett.
Okay, I've got some important stuff here. Suddenly there's a new superstar, according to the New York Observer, a critical analysis of the weekly news, and probably other media before the New York Observer. But here's what's interesting. What is her image? In the ad for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the Cleopatra of its generation, due out next month. I guess they're saying the Cleopatra because that's when Richard Burton and Liz Taylor had an affair, right?
Yes.
Hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
In the ad for Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which Brad somebody, what's this guy's last name?
Brad Pitt.
Yeah, Brad Pitt and Angelina meet. In this ad, there's Angelina Jolie, sans Brad Pitt, legs up like a flamingo. A friend says to the journalist, who is a woman named Susie Hansen, in that picture, you know what she's saying, a friend said recently. She's saying, I'm effing beautiful, F you. All right? This is what she's saying in the picture. I'm effing beautiful, F you. Now, the journalist says, this is not something Julia Roberts said in ads for Pretty Woman, although her pose was similar. Not something Nicole Kidman could muster up on a good day. Charlize Theron, too pretty. Halle Berry, too unhinged. Hilary Swank, no. Gwyneth Paltrow? No, no, no. In fact, the only actresses who share Miss Jolie's confidence are foreign actresses of the old school. Sophie Loren, Jeanne Monroe, Bridget Bardot at her best. Then they say maybe the Maggie Chungs and Ziyu Zhangs of today. You know who they are?
Yes, the Chinese film stars.
Are they today or in the past?
Today.
Because they're saying the so-and-so of today, but
yes.
That's not a grammatically correct way.
Anyway. Right, okay. So they're in House of Flying Daggers and Hero, several
and
other
they're
films.
More aggressive looking?
I guess.
Okay, so...
Well, they do all the jujitsu and karate stuff, so they're obviously aggressive.
Okay, there you go, okay.
Oh, okay, that's what they cite, as I'm going to tell you in a minute. Angelina's pretty good at. It says, that's because Americans prefer the girls next door. Smiley, sweet girl eunuchs clamoring for the next bad romantic comedy or period drama when they should be home practicing that flamingo pose. Now, they go on to say that the charisma of this new image, this is a new kind of feminine hero. She's brought back the big, beautiful, silty riverbed of American romance. Queen of the photo op, goodwill ambassador for the United Nations, free-loving promiscuite, rippling action hero, adoptive mum, daughter of a Hollywood Duke of the 70s, and Oscar winner. Oh, and homewrecker. In case you thought that story was gone from American life, left back in the age of Liz eyeing Eddie and Debbie while they lounged on a Hollywood chaise as though she were ready to swallow them whole. The old conventional wisdom was that the American woman was supposed to hate that homewrecker. The only storyline more resonant than the born man-stealer like Angelina Jolie. The only storyline more resonant than the dream of true love and everlasting happiness is the one that involves the imminence of envy, infidelity, and divorce. And so there's really nothing for everyday women to like about a homewrecker, a born man-stealer like Angelina Jolie. Ask Laura Dern. Was Laura Dern involved with anybody along this? Was she involved with Brad Pitt, maybe? Did Angelina take away her husband?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
And wasn't it Melanie Griffith who refused to leave Antonio Banderas' side when he ripped Angelina's bodice on the set of some movie we can't remember?
Bodice, Bob.
Bodice.
Bodice. What did I say?
Bodice?
That's the Canadian version. Now she's been charged with breaking up a marriage that most Hollywood consumers happily and delusionally believe was perfect. That would be the Pitt Anistons. L'affaire Pitt Jolie began, or was perhaps imagined, on the set of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and naturally was followed by a love fest across the continent of Africa, cruelly interrupted in Morocco, as so Mrs. Jolie could jet off to save the children of South Asia. A is for Audrey Hepburn. It may have seemed that Miss Jolie, Tomb Raider, was poised to go the way of Ingrid and Liz, the perennial other woman, the selfish lady who spirits away the most leading of men, the she-devil who earns the scorn of thin-lipped. Now, there's prejudice. Ever look at people of thin-lipped and assume they have no passion? Anyways, the she-devil who earns the scorn of thin-lipped mortals everywhere, except that she doesn't. Ah, here's the threat. Here's the new ground. Few women would begrudge their lover a night with Angelina Jolie. It's different. She inspires curiosity above all else. At once beautiful and terrifying, Miss Jolie, in every movie scene and every photograph, seems to be casting a spell like a sorceress with right eyebrow gracefully, spookily arched, just like Zappa used to do. Does Zappa know something? It seems as though she could lift weights with that brow, or something out of the Lord of the Rings. It's that weirdness, along with the lore of knife-playing, blood-filing, and lover-taking, at odds with, but not completely at odds with, the images of maternal bliss that keeps her captivating, if a little alien.
Okay, wait, hold on. Yeah, a bit alien in looks, I would say. But, nonetheless, you know, you're leaving out the fact that there's many a woman that can totally understand that Angelina was irresistibly drawn to Brad Pitt. I mean, it's like he's Mr. Innocent, or
yeah.
She was not pulled by his, you know, movie star charm and good looks. Give me a break. Have you ever seen Thelma and Louise?
I saw that.
Okay, so that's what made him a star. Every woman in the theater just sighed, and I'm putting it nicely.
Right, so you're saying this woman projection, now this could be part of it. No.
I mean, if they're always doing it, it's the woman. She's the homewrecker, right? So, and, you know, it takes two to tango. And same with Richard Burton and Liz Taylor, as well as Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie.
Okay, this is a good point, Julie, because when I'm going to come to this journalist sums up the great appeal of Angelina's image. Now, this is a woman journalist writing about this. It looks like the sexes are involved in their own little matrix pods and projecting their own reality, forgetting these first nature instincts that you're citing, or at least the men might think that Brad did it, but the women think she did it. All right, so she says, all of this is to say that for women, Ms. Angelina is yet another case of confusing affection with well-intentioned envy. Just as women often fall in love with men they actually want to be because they're so free or because they're more powerful, women fall in love with Ms. Jolie, perhaps for her solitude above all else. So while the Brad Jennifer Angelina story will continue for now, it still plays second fiddle to another triangle of recent memory. That of Ms. Jolie, her son, and the starving children of the world. Now, she's gone out, and I'm going to get to this point, and this is where I'm leading to, the starving children of the world endeavor. Ever since her divorce from the spit-swapping Billy Bob Thornton, the whole new being has taken over.
Okay, Billy Bob was with Laura Dern.
Ah, and then he got... Okay, you remember that now.
It came back.
The girl who played, they're talking about Angelina, the girl who played with razors and wore blood to her wedding became an immaculately dressed traveler of the third world. The woman twice married and prone to kissing her brother became someone who rides carriages in Central Park only with her son. The girl who sported tattoos of her Billy Bob had them rubbed off. She dedicated her life to getting her life back together. She stopped seeming so weird It really does seem like she's always with Maddox as the son. And yet the wily Spectres remains, even peering out from under a head wrap in countries where they mutilate girls as a matter of course. All in all, it's a stunning self-transformation or calculation. She's got the man who used to be married to America's best friend, the girl next door, that nice, nice girl, but it's hard to hate her for it. Angelina Jolie, the brave actress who does her own stunts and raises her own kid and has plenty of tattoos and plenty of boyfriends because it's better that way. The woman looks so good in Vanity Fair and so proud in Washington. I think that was at the correspondence dinner. Is a deregulated movie star of our era. Deregulated. What is that woman doing? She's seducing us, and she'll do it again. Now, what's interesting is that she falls back on this old icon stereotype of being seen with starving children. You don't see her supporting the Friends of Freedom or supporting the drug industries. Drug industries own the movies. It's amazing that we could deconstruct this person if they listen to Carol's stuff and realize that her image is falling back. Her image of being a caring person is revolving around images from 30 years ago. And that's where she shows her dumbness. So they're celebrating this woman because she's totally free. Free! Yet it's written into the American Constitution that democracy is not here to make us free. It's here to make us perfect. Is she trying to make herself perfect by going with old humanitarian imagery and not noticing the real humanitarian efforts would be to deal with the dominance of France Renew and his network of the chemical body? And she seems to be not too involved with her chemical body. She's not concerned about its instinctual moral bonds. It's into being an image, but an image that is deregulated, not limited to the movie. An image that's involved with the chip body and the chip body's effort to help everybody, serve everybody. So, Carol, if you ever meet her, point out to her that she's killing more people than anybody could ever do by sending food to them.
But, you know, that's the image that, you know, we create. That image, we feed into that image of her. You know, whether she very well is using that image, you know, we can't really make that judgment against her, not knowing her, not being her. And maybe she was captured by these starving children, you know, in Cambodia when she was there and moved to be an ambassador for them. Why not?
Maybe that's, okay, this is where it's stereotypical. They live a life of TV body. But they have nostalgia for the chemical body, and the great vision of chemical body humanitarianism is helping other chemical bodies get food. She doesn't know that those kids are lost in the effect of the chip body, and the chip body leaves drug companies running everything. And
Bob, nobody knows that except you.
Well, why? No, Dr. Dean. I mean, this is the problem. Why can't activists? With Michael Moore, apparently Michael Moore is making a movie on the drug connection to the healthcare system, right?
Yeah, it's called Sicko.
Oh, is it really Sicko?
Yeah.
So maybe he's going to popularize the idea of the healthcare system and how that's a bigger problem than starvation. It really is a bigger problem, you know.
Well, it's a... Yeah...
You know,
what do you mean it's a bigger problem? I mean, like, okay, so we have to give it precedence over children starving to death?
Yeah, children starving, those people die. The people who are still here are the ones polluting the world and destroying the planet and First Nature, and they're locked into the effects of the TV body and the chip body, which means the IG Farben German cartel will lock down the next 200 years. And this is the world we'll be living in, and that's where minds will be determined. They can keep some parts of the world healthy, keeping them alive and fed, but it's those people that are inside that womb of security that will be imprisoned in a tyranny beyond any tyranny that comes from dying. The worst torture is to be still here.
Well, you know, you can see from Carolyn's experience, and I hope everybody is grasping that, as, you know, medical doctor, respected author, media savvy, doctor of many, you know, genres, including MD, naturopath, homeopath, acupuncturist, can go into a meeting and they sit there and play their Blackberries. All right, so you know, at least she, you know, someone like Angelina Jolie can do something concrete for individuals. That yes, many of them are going to die, and then many of them will not. All right,
yes,
and have a chance at life. So what's happening now with the pharmaceutical companies and the corporations? That's a whole different fight that has to be taken on, and. So much of it is because of the chip body, TV body, brain indoctrination, that we need that pill. And that started a long time ago, looking for that one pill that's going to do it all.
Yes, and with the media, the way they play the population, you see interviews or surveys now of children, and when they're asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? It's not a doctor or a humanitarian or someone who helps the poor. It's not a Mother Teresa. They want to be Angelina Jolie. They want to be Brad Pitt, because that's what's held up as the pinnacle of our society. And then they get up there.
Carol, let me just say, not the pinnacle. It's that the TV body lasts longer than the chemical body. It's the idea that you'll be made immortal. That came in with the printing press. You could project your image over time through the book. But now these people realize that second nature is way more powerful than first nature, and that's where reality or significance is.
Okay, wait a minute. So let me just jump in here, because in this morning's paper, I think it was Parade Magazine, in their little, you know, quips in the beginning, question and answer, someone asked the question, what did Brad Pitt see in Angelina Jolie that he did not see in Jennifer Aniston? And I thought it was an interesting answer, in that the guy was very serious, and he said that she is, you know, working in the world to save starving children, and he is working in the world to alleviate hunger. And Jennifer Aniston is off trying to make a career for herself that they already have. So in other words, you know, it was like, well, they are justified in infidelity and destroying a marriage because they are helping others.
Right.
While Jennifer is selfishly pursuing her career. It was
right.
Like, it was astounding to read that.
Who said this? A citizen?
No, this was in the this was an answer to the question in this Parade magazine that goes out to, you know, millions and millions of people on Sunday mornings.
Who gave the answer? The journalist?
Yeah, the journalist. I guess he has a regular column. I don't know. I don't usually read it, so I don't know who it is. But it's like on the inside cover of, you know, the magazine.
But that's understandable, is that the newspaper and a point of view world, the 19th century world of issues in the chemical body, thinks, so that's really the medium of the magazine speaking, they think that humanitarian things are more important, and that's their bias, whereas Jennifer knows that her staying alive in the TV body is more important. So in the TV industry, they might have a different spin from the TV body's point of view in the TV industry. That's the journalist's view, that it's that humanitarian issues are more powerful. But the journalist is living in a cliche environment where he thinks those forms of service are more significant than career. That's an illusion. I mean, just...
Okay, we got to take a break here soon. We're ready for a music break there, Bob.
Okay.
Are you finished?
Well, yeah, I just want to say that the government people that Carol encountered, and she encountered the same indifference in Washington, there, you're encountering government 19th century institutions that know that they must remain hooked into the chip body and the TV body, even for them to be viable. And that's the hypocrisy, that the education system does not tell the kids that their governments and nations aren't there anymore in a viable way.
And we'll be right back. You're listening to Homegrown Radio, NJ.com. Building Organic Bodies. Hey, shoot us an email at live@buildingorganicbodies.com. We'll be waiting to hear from you. With me, Delia Quigley, Dr. Carolyn Dean, and Bob Neverett. And okay, so I have one. Are you guys there?
Yeah, we're here.
All right, my turn. All right, so Bob, when did the first Matrix come out?
The first Matrix and March, April,
99. Okay. So I was watching this movie called Fire in the Sky, 1993. All right. Now, this drama is based on a true story. And the story goes that there is a bunch of loggers, you know, logging up in the back Arizona woods, and they're coming back late, and they come upon this spaceship, right? And one of them, fooling around, gets out, goes stands under the spaceship, and they zap him. And the other guy, then he falls down, and the other guys think he's dead, so they speed away. And so they get down the mountain, and the guy who's driving is this guy, Travis Walton, who got zapped, best friend. So he says, I'm going back. And they say, no, you're crazy. No, I'm going back. So he goes back up there, and Travis is gone. And so is the spaceship. So these guys, they go back into town, and they tell the story. And, of course, nobody believes them. Everybody thinks that they killed Travis. And they bring in the big, you know, fancy country sheriff, played, of course, by James Gardner. And so, anyway, about 5 days later, Travis shows up, buck naked and seriously traumatized, and talks about how he was taken on board. All right? Now, when he finally starts remembering his adventure on board, it was very interesting because the ship is this cavernous. They all had lie detector tests, and they all passed the lie detector tests, even though they took the lie detector test a number of times. So whether that has any standing or not, I don't know. But in this cavernous spaceship, of course, he wakes up in something similar to what was in the Matrix. You know, like in this pod. And in the pod is just, you know, this gooey, nasty, viscous stuff all over him. And around him is this membrane, as if he was in like a womb membrane. And he manages to push through it and falls out. And of course, you know, he's weightless. And, you know, these guys who grab, he ends up encountering the aliens. And they look like, you know, some odd-looking little old men, not unlike E.T., but not really a lot like E.T. And then they slap him on the table, right? And, I mean, they're dragging him around, treating him like an animal, and they slap him on the table, and he's screaming like crazy, and they put this sheet over him that immediately starts to adhere I don't know, something you put through an instant wrap, plastic wrap thing that just adheres him to the table. And they, down from the ceiling comes this machine, and this, you know, thin needle comes out and into his eye, and they get all this, okay. So I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, well, here we are thinking these aliens are like superior beings or something, right? And they're just a bunch of knuckleheads with no more compassion than most human beings. And they need machines, and they need these big, you know, X-ray machines. And if this is, has any truth to it at all, which is, you know, pretty much out there. But the other interesting part about this is that so many people around the country have reported similar experiences and similar testing and probing and prodding. And when he was falling through this cavernous, almost honeycomb honeycombs. Yes, he fell into one, and there was one guy was in there dead and rather dismembered. And so I'm just putting that out in terms of the image we might have of a superior intelligence that managed to make it to this planet in a spacecraft, and what we might expect from them, and what we might consider them to be very similar to us in many ways.
So Delia, I know the story. The guy Travis, I think is his real name. I've seen him and heard him interviewed on TV shows or more cable obscure shows that have those kind of people on. And I never believed his story, but it's undeniable that the experience he had follows the stereotypical experience that a lot of people have. So I came up with an interpretation of the E.T. figure, which is a little short guy with bulging eyes. And
big head, little skinny body.
Right, and I see it as a merger of the chip body and the TV body. And so people, when we made the transition from the TV body and the chip body in the 70s and 80s, as people became more conscious of it, they saw the TV image, which is a cyclopean, and for Americans, a big eyeball, like the Illuminati eyeball, this one-eyed or two-eyed big baby look is what everybody is inside the TV body. We're all like 1 or 2, 3 years old emotionally under TV conditions. So you have the body, this, and you're flying by television. That's the unidentified flying object. You're traveling, massive collective ESP. Everybody's traveling everywhere under TV conditions. Then when the chip body comes, it sticks a pin into the third eye, the big eye, and is an invasion. So it's really interesting that the pin, which is like a symbol of the chip body, penetrates the TV image. And then on top of that, they have this popular name for them. There's another variation of the image, is the reptilians. Now, if you ever look at color TV and look at the scanning colored pixels, especially if you're stoned, you will see that they are like the skin of a snake. And so the reptilian idea of the alien is another projection of the TV body. The wavering, pulsing TV pixels are like the reptilian skin of a snake. And so the reptilian invasion, that's the TV body run amok, inside a chip body, which is freeing up like Angelina Jolie to run around in her chemical body and do rearview mirror stuff as an art form, because the real action takes place in the TV chip body. So the reptilian TV body becomes very aggressive, a hot medium, no longer a cool medium, and it's penetrated by the piercing chip body. And so the victim of this is the consumer, who sees himself penetrated and basically examined in the genital region. A lot of these abductees get investigated down there. And that's because that's the most intimate part, the most sacred part that has to be violated to communicate the impact of the chip body violating the TV body. So that's how I began to think about this standard image of the aliens, which goes between the little Spielberg E.T. baby guy to the reptilians.
Okay, so given that there is, you know, so many people reporting the same type of encounters,
yeah.
Could there be any truth to it?
Well, according to my great sources, there were only 5 people abducted as of 1988 in the 20th century. 2 of them were Barney Hill and Betty Hill, and she died about a year ago, and she was real, and she always stood by her story, had lots of proof for it in science when the map they revealed was confirmed 10 years later in the middle 70s. But she was very upset at this rampant image. She didn't feel that it was true. But she and her husband were really abducted by the Boudians and 2 other people who never told anybody. My source said that there would be a couple of abductees in the 90s, but they generally probably wouldn't tell anybody. So when Travis comes along in the late 80s, early 90s, he's going along the standard description, and he's projecting second nature media effects into his encounter, which is all in his head. And that does not stop the Boudians, though, abducting a couple people, but they don't give that experience. You'd have to look at what Barney and Betty Hill went through to see the kind of experience they had.
But I thought it was interesting that the Matrix, I don't know if you've seen the film Fire in the Sky, that the Matrix took that experience and recreated it in their own way.
And made it accurate, because they showed the interface of the TV body with the chip body. I mean, they would jack into the chip body. That's what Neo and the guys did.
Right.
And they get punctured to do it. I hadn't thought of it, but that's backing up a common understanding of the chip body as an acupuncture, an acupressure beating, an acubeating. It's getting you in your meridians. It's just sticking it to you, right?
Sticking it to you, absolutely. Okay, well, I thought I'd just bring up that little point because...
Yeah, so you're wondering about the common stereotypical trip that people go through, and maybe there's technological reasons, using the TV body, chip body, but doesn't deny... That I'm not denying that there are some people abducted, but there are only a few of them, and they're not talking about it. You know, so I believe there are UFOs occasionally checking out people, but they do it really ecologically.
So, and once again, we're back to, we don't know. There is no way to know.
Until it happens to us.
Until it happens to you. Exactly.
But that never stopped humans. We don't need to know. See, that's another thing we got to consider. Humans don't need to know to communicate. You know, they never did need to know.
Right.
It's actually a product of Western literacy, is to emphasize truth and the facts and what is knowable, what's repeatable. The fact that the printed book was repeatable, you could make one book look just like the previous book when you mass produced them. That never had, no one had ever had that experience before. No one ever saw anything exactly repeatable. So the repeatable motif went into science, saying you've got to reproduce the experiment to have truth. But that was an effect of literacy. We don't need this idea that humans need to know in order to communicate is not true. Humans communicate out of the use of the pleasure of using their senses, and speech translates the use of their senses. And then we got all this new media. So that's a very pleasurable experience being human. You know what I mean?
It is. You know, and that, it's interesting you say that, because one of the other articles I wanted to bring up was the in this recent magazine, ODE, about the heart and how the studies that shows that the heart is much more important than the brain to overall health and well-being, even cognitive function, than anyone has ever known. It's they're finding that through biofeedback, right, with the brain. But they're finding now that it's really through the heart that that people can change their state of being. All right, and so this company called HeartMath, which was established in 1991 by Doc Lou Childress. Have you heard about this, Carolyn?
Yes, there's a website called HeartMath.com
right.
that has a lot of this information on it. That it's quite remarkable.
They say it's you know, they measure the HeartMath programs utilize an innovative biofeedback system. Whereby your finger or ear is hooked up to a sensor that shows the heart's activity on a computer screen. The feedback is not a precondition for the result of the heart math exercises, but seeing your heart rhythms live on a computer screen makes it easier to convince critics of the favorable effects of positive feelings. All right. The research conducted 10 years ago by Dr. Andrew Armour of Dalhousie University in Halifax, Canada, showed that the heart has its own neural network, in essence, a little brain. The heart rhythm, the HRV, the time period between two heartbeats, plays a key role in that network. It has now been demonstrated that the heart sends signals to the brain and the hormonal system via nerves which carry the heart rhythm patterns. It doesn't matter so much how many times a heart beats per minute, it's the rhythm of the heartbeat that counts. So simply put, when people experience love, they not only feel happy and joyful, but they also produce, for example, more DHEA, the hormone that prevents aging and gives us feelings of youthful vitality. And they, so they find that using this heart math technique and these exercises, with you can literally change your state of being, experience more positive feelings, and actually begin to generate love.
What is the name of that Dr. Delia in Dalhousie? Because that's where I went to medical school.
Andrew Armour, A-R-M-O-U-R.
Hmm.
All right.
Very interesting. Well, that reminds me of the work you did with Dr. Irving Dardick.
I know, because I
was... heart cycles.
I was expecting to find his name in here, but and he's still doing that with the Life Waves program.
Hmm.
So they found that in working with this group, for example, you know, working in corporations and also working with children in schools, because the biggest problem they're saying that people are having today is stress. So it's using this program works against stress. So when they worked with a group of managers from Motorola, one quarter of the managers had high blood pressure at the start of the project. After 6 months, they all had normal blood pressure levels. And same thing at the Hewlett-Packard managers. The average blood pressure fell from 138 over 86 to 128 over 80. This large an improvement is comparable to the effect of losing nearly 20 or 44 pounds. They found that the exercises also work for people with chronic diseases. For example, diabetes patients who performed a total of 1 hour of heart math exercises every week for 6 months scored significantly better on a number of health aspects crucial to them. So,
what are the exercises?
So, for example, one of the exercises is a very interesting because it's very similar to a meditation breath system that that we use in meditation, and it's called like the heart focus. So one, you focus your attention in the area of your heart, gently focus in the center of your chest, the area of your heart, and if your mind wanders, keep shifting your attention back to the area of your heart. So focusing on the area of your heart, pretend your breath is flowing in and out through that area. Breathe slowly and gently in through your heart to a count of 5 or 6, and slowly and easily out through your heart to a count of 5 or 6. Do this until your breathing feels smooth and balanced and you find an easy rhythm. As you continue to breathe through the area of your heart, recall a positive feeling, a time when you felt good inside, and try to re-experience it. Allow yourself to feel this good a feeling of appreciation or care. If at first you can't feel anything, it's okay. Just try to find a sincere attitude of appreciation or care. Once you've found a positive feeling or attitude, sustain it by continuing your heart focus, heart breathing, and heart feeling. So in heart lock-in steps, gently shift your attention to the area around your heart. Shift your breathing so that you're breathing in through the heart and out through the solar plexus. Activate a genuine feeling of appreciation or care for someone or something in your life. Make a sincere effort to sustain feelings of appreciation, care, or love while radiating them to yourself and others. When you catch your mind wandering, gently focus your breathing back through the heart and solar plexus and reconnect with feelings of care or appreciation. After you've finished, sincerely sustain your feelings of care and appreciation as long as you can. This will act as a cushion against recurring stress or anxiety. So they found that there's this, in all of these studies, because they have a huge amount of studies, that the studies show that the electromagnetic field of the heart, which is created by the heart's electrical system or electrocardiogram, can be measured from between 2 and 3 meters from the body. HeartMath has discovered that if someone has a coherent heart rhythm, it has a demonstrably positive effect on other people in close proximity to him or her. And the reverse is also true. Just think about how you feel in the presence of someone who is appreciative or caring compared to being close to someone angry or frustrated. But even more interestingly, it talks about how the heart has this, its own intuition. And they would do this this testing involving like 26 people. So for example, a woman would sit in front of a computer screen. The middle finger of her right hand is connected to a sensor that measures her heart rhythm. There are sensors on her head that measure her brain waves. The screen is black. Following an interval, an image appears on the screen. Then it goes black again. After a while, another image appears, followed once more by a black screen. This process continues for several minutes. The images the woman sees are randomly presented on the screen. Neither she, the researcher, nor the computer knows what image will be next. Many of the images depict beautiful, peaceful things, a waterfall, a tree, a cute animal. Every so often, an image of something cruel or aggressive is shown. A car accident, a bloody knife, a hissing snake. Occasionally, the subject sees sexually explicit images. Systematically, approximately 4.5 seconds before a cruel image appeared on the screen, a spike appears on the graph measuring heart rhythms. This is not the case before the calm pictures. Not only that, but it is the heart rhythm that first shows that a negative image is coming. The brain waves react a couple of seconds after the heart, but still before the image has actually appeared on the screen. So Roland McCrotty, who leads the research team at HeartMath, speaks of this as one of the most groundbreaking studies conducted by his institute. This study demonstrates that people are apparently intuitively aware of future negative events. It also demonstrates that the human heart appears to have access to an information field. Whether or not people act on this intuitive information is another story. We have been conditioned to dismiss our intuitive insights, but the body is designed to provide the hardware for just such a process. Interesting, eh?
Fascinating.
So chew on that, and we're going to take a quick music break.
Dearly, just before you do this, think about this during the break, is that we were talking about how people, how do we know anything? Now, there's a lot of knowing going on in that study, and I relate that to the anxiety. The problem we have today is that people don't have a collective way of knowing or sharing matching anymore. That's the context that any of these experiments are forced to put in, the people go into, and that's the root of the anxiety. So it's a translation into a collective space that we are totally at a loss to do anymore. That's what you mean when you say, how do we know? You mean, what do we share? So I just wanted to mention that.
Math and the so you can generate love is what it's saying. You can learn to generate love even when you're not feeling like it, or you haven't known or experienced love, or you know you're really depressed, and you can generate love by this method that they have. Comments?
Well, I went to the website and they have a machine that you can purchase called the frame freezer, I think it is, where you you learn, I guess, I would assume it's like a biofeedback machine. It will take your pulse and maybe also measure your galvanic skin response, which is a measurement of the sweat you release, to learn how to generate love. I think Delia mentioned when I said this off air that, well, you know, you just do the exercise and you get the results. Some people need to have a machine, a feedback system to know where they're at with that.
And they have to pay $275 to feel like they're getting their worth, right?
Right. But what's interesting, we talk about stress and the main thing that the focus of this therapy is on stress, and I've been reading about stress for decades, and a recent article I happened upon, the author talked about, well, you know, how is stress any different now than it was 1,000 years ago or 100 years ago, when 1,000 years ago people were running away from wild animals, and that's pretty stressful, or people going across America, you know, the early settlers who were being attacked by others constantly, didn't know if they'd wake up in the middle of the night and be under attack. I mean, that's stress. So how does the stress of today somehow become so significantly, you know, so much greater than previous stress?
Well, that's what I meant about the collective point. People, you know, in the jungles, they had common stories to assuage the stress. One of the definitions that conventional artists give for art is it inspires people. But if you broaden the term art to, say, the stories we tell each other in whatever medium, the stories inspire a sense of community, a sense of safety. And it's known through McLuhan's research that whenever you bring in a major medium which alters the storytelling style, it causes incredible stress. And we have a record of this with the printing press with Hieronymus Bosch's paintings, those famous paintings of the anxiety that people went through in that period of the printing press. So every new medium is going to create great stress. What's amazing about this medium, about our present situation, is that it is upsetting anybody's sense of community so much, because you can't find anything that your body relates to, so you can't begin to have a story. So that's what I mean when I say the collective knowing is under stress. The collective stories, the older media that provided assuagement or a bomb for that BALM, cannot occur under chip body. So the reason this is a time of greatest stress is that the stories in older media don't comfort anymore, don't give security. Now that means, the service of that is that people can explore the old bodies, the astral body, and the chemical body, and find all kinds of interesting new abilities in it. All right? Since it's not the main ground anymore, it becomes an art form. It becomes something that we explore. So we're going to get all kinds of new studies and understanding of how people can enhance their bodies and brains and hearts, you know, tenfold. But they'll always be within the larger stress, greater stress, of no common story.
Okay. But I think, you know, that as we develop more instruments, more chip body instruments, more technology to monitor and register the chemical body, we're just going to continue to explore it. You know, and look at it and monitor it. I mean, I was reminded of that as I'm watching these alien beings, you know, supposedly have at Travis, right, with all these machines. It's like, well, that's what we do. We're not, you know, it's us doing it to ourselves. You know, it's the collective fantasy that, you know, there are these alien beings, you know, experimenting on us, when in fact we're doing that to ourselves. And the behavior of these alien beings is no different than, you know, the most crass technician, right, in the medical field.
In the medical field. So that's why it's a projection. That's why it isn't the aliens, is that we're projecting a laboratory experience, which is a normal experience for 20th century people, but it has a common denominator across cultures of people having the same image. So that's where you bring in the TV body and the chip body.
But you see, what we're not doing is that we're not, you know, seeing the reality that it is us. You know, so we can skip over what's happening with the pharmaceutical companies. We can ignore it. We can put it aside as if they were really doing us, you know, some good. And that's not to say that modern medicine is totally bad. I mean, modern medicine is saves lives. But at the same time, you know, we have to look at the reality, and instead of really seeing what's happening with the overabundance of medications and death by modern medicine, as Dr. Dean has written, we're projecting it onto these alien beings that have nothing to do with it.
Yeah, see, so when I say we don't have a common story, that means to look at, there's no medium, larger medium that people live in. McLuhan has this great quote at the end of War and Peace in the Global Village, where he talks about that in the microorganismic world, they were inbreeders, and humans and animals were outbreeders. And he quotes from a science text, and then he substitutes the term inbreeders in a new context, where under electronic conditions, he's writing this in the late 60s, all of first nature, humans and animals, become microorganismic, and the media, the habitats that we're now living in, the new bodies, they become the outbreeders. They're the macroorganismic. So the outbreeding, invasion of this situation of media, that's why, you know, if you enter into the TV body, chip body with the goal of personal salvation, personal security, you won't get it. So the drug companies, because they're a victim of the chip body's inability to provide a common story, they're having as much anxiety. And you will find executives in the IG Farben terrorists working with the Francois Junot Network who do this meditation on the sideline to assuage their anxiety while they go around preparing the next suicide bomber. The suicide bomber is a response to the collective agony of no story, but personal revelation and personal experiences, what McLuhan called the millennium of ecstatics, the discovering of the old chip body and astral body potentials, is engaged by those that on the political level are terrorists. Because they're responding in their terrorism to the lack of collective security, collective shared story, but they probably read these studies and do a little meditation on their own.
Well, something I have to add, the New York Times wants to work on the chip body and the chemical body and the TV body by using implant devices for depression. So how is that for treating our body as if it were a machine?
Yeah, that's the chemical body. See, that's the chemical body is like you take it into a garage and get a mechanic worked on.
Right.
These electronic chips you can stick in the chemical body.
Yeah, it's a pacemaker-like device called a vagus nerve stimulator, surgically implanted into the upper chest. Its wires are threaded into the neck, where it stimulates the nerve leading to the brain. It's been approved since 1997 for the treatment of some epilepsy patients, and the FDA has told the manufacturer that it is now approvable for severe depression that is resistant to other treatments. And I mean, they can say that, but what the experience is with modern medicine, when you think of the surgical procedure of removing people's stomachs for obesity, and they say it's just for people who are hopelessly obese, yet, you know, people line up and get this surgery who you know, aren't as threatened by their obesity. So I'm sure a lot of people will be lining up and thinking, well, I don't want to swallow any pills or have my family member swallow pills. Let's just do this procedure.
So yeah. What's happening then is, you know, that's going to replace the pill.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking for now, rather, since they cannot find all of these solutions in one pill, that they're going to put a machine into us that is going to provide all the solutions, stimulate this, stimulate that. When what HeartMath is saying is you got to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not much work. You just, you know, a couple of, like 30 seconds a day, or, you know, over the course of a week, maybe three times a week, 30 seconds a day or something, and you'll be happy. You'll stimulate that happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But for many people, that's like, oh, 30 seconds. I don't have time for 30 seconds.
Right.
If you go around being happy, you got to be very careful how you communicate that to others, because you're going to anger other people in your workplace or wherever you interact with humans. They'll pick up on this, and you'll look like a zombie to them.
But no, but they're putting it in the workplace. I mean, the corporations are taking some because it's costing them, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in lost productivity. People don't show up for work when they're not feeling, you know, when they're depressed.
Yeah, when you can do it in a workforce where everybody agrees to, that's different. But I'm saying if you personally get better and get healthy, you got to be careful who you communicate that to, because a lot of people will react negatively to the positive vibes you give out.
No, but I don't find that to be true. I find that, as they say here, you know, people when they're in the, you know, in my presence, when with that mood, and I'm sure I've seen it with Carolyn as well, you know, they just pick up on it and it calms them down.
In a certain quiet context, but not everywhere.
I don't know, that might be your experience, Bob.
No, I can generate calmness all over the place. But I do notice other people try to do it, and they get in trouble. There's a certain knack in how to communicate warmth and inclusiveness that doesn't rub people the wrong way.
Well, it depends if you're being genuine or if you're being false and making it up.
Yeah, and it also...
being overbearing.
Yes, but people are strange, and they... You can't control a person's reaction to you.
When I got involved with the health freedom movement, Truman Tuck, who's the founder of Friends of Freedom, he said, you got to figure that 50% of people will love you and 50% of people will hate you when you're doing this type of work. But I realized that that's the way it is in life.
Yeah.
It's the way it is in politics. 50% of people vote conservative, 50% vote liberal. In America, Republican, Democrat.
That's the
thing. The world is split equally down the middle.
That's a dynamic in families or between the sexes. The point is that an act of identity is an act of violence. And for you to have an identity in relation to someone else, and it's a deep need, you're going to be asserting yourself as opposed to someone else. That's the common thread. That's the human condition.
Right, and people can step away from their peers or their colleagues or their neighbors in many different ways as well. For example, start eating differently. Start eating healthy, or go out with your buddies who drink and don't drink. You know, any of those kind of things are going to set you apart and really anger people because you are doing something different from them. They can't identify with you.
You're establishing a different identity, including maybe diminishing the accepted. Concerned about the identity.
Well, you know, it's not even so much that you diminish it, it's not your intention to diminish it, but people feel that they're threatened by your change.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Suddenly they're wrong. You know, they impose that view that they're wrong because you've changed. There's something wrong with the way things were.
Yes, that's how intimate people are, intimately connected. I mean, Krishnamurti says, one person changes, completely, holistically, generally changes, that causes a revolution, that wrenches other people, because we are interconnected. So you're changing others when you change.
Well, look what's happening over in Europe. Phyllis Schlafly, May 4th, wrote about the, I guess it's a vote May 29th over in France about whether or not they want to stay in the EU. This is what it sounds like. And the European ruling elite is having a collective nervous breakdown for fear the French will vote no on May 29th and reject the European Constitution. 11 opinion polls indicated it is likely that democracy may upset the power-seeking politicians' undemocratic plans. So that's very interesting because...
Do you know who Phyllis Schlafly is?
I've heard the name.
No, she's the Bill Buckley of the conservative movement. She started the conservative movement in the 60s and was the one who took on the feminists.
And so she's
the super Republican... going way back. I mean, she's probably 80 years old now. And if that's the same person, it's interesting what she's saying, because she's probably an isolationist. A lot of the conservatives are against the United Nations or any big world order.
Right, because she says the politicians and bureaucrats who dream of world government, or at least continental government, to be run by a commission of technocrats who think they are wiser than ordinary people, have progressed a long way toward their goal, starting with the common market and then morphing it into the current European Union.
Yeah, that's her. That's the kind of talk. She's happy that this is breakdown's happening.
Well, you know, my work with the food supplements, Codex seems to be controlled by Germany and the European Union to direct us toward standardizing our dietary supplements. And by bureaucrats and technocrats who just want to make things easy or, you know, create this standardization. Some of us think, well, people believe the world is so chaotic, let's just control a few things that we can. But, you know, when they do it on dietary supplements that affect our health and our freedom to choose, then, you know, that's where I rebel.
Right. See, and you have right wingers on your side, the left wingers, the old divisions. Can and we're here to supposedly offer solutions. If we start talking about the four bodies, then we'd be clear on what the issues are, because the German cartels, the WTO, are trying to hijack the chemical body, which is like a ghetto that they can work with. And people are accepting the chip being planted in them because we're post-chip body, so people are getting friendly with the chip. It's not as much of a threat. So, you can bring these people together who have different political allegiances if we use the new perceptual map.
Okay, but hold on a second, because people are starting to feel the pinch of the chip body and looking to come back together. An example is also in Ode magazine that how communities are bringing back gathering places, you know, in the towns that people can walk and hang out, cafes, that they can, you know, court each other again. And they said that was very common in cities and towns all over the world, but that changed during the 20th century, when cars took over the streets in industrialized nations and wide swaths of the developing world too, putting many more places within easy reach but making walking and biking dangerous. Towns and cities spread out with many merchants moving to outlying shopping malls. Telephones, refrigerators, television, computers, and suburban homes with big yards transformed our daily lives. People withdrew from the public realm. No longer essential, public spaces were neglected. Many newly constructed communities simply forgot about sidewalks, parks, downtowns, transit, playgrounds, and people's pleasure in taking a walk after dinner and bumping into their neighbors. Today, many folks wonder if public spaces serve any real purpose anymore. But they're finding that they're crucial, you know, to people not pulling away and being separate, right? That someone coined the word, I think Faith Popcorn in her book on cocooning, that people are going off and separating themselves from the rest of community, when in fact it's really crucial to maintaining community, is having these places that people can gather.
Yeah, now, we'll take that one trend, people are doing that, then match it up with all the other trends we've been talking about for weeks. The search for community in the mall churches. Then you have the ability through cell phones for people having to have affairs at noon hour while at work.
We didn't talk about that one.
Maybe that was on another show, on the other station. Remember I was telling you about the hacking of emails, lovers' emails?
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yeah. And the thing is that defining community is the issue here. What is community? I mean, people who share one favorite TV show and then have a chat line on a website, they're very involved with a sense of community. But it's the orchestrating of the four bodies, chemical, astral, TV, and chip, which is the task for creating community. Now, the chip body, as we have people more and more being implanted in it, and scientists exchanging human brain cells with animal cells, you have this parallel movement of France trying to withdraw maybe from the ECU, or people going out to cafes. You know, there's a real, you know, inventory of effects we can do show here. But the fact that the chip body gets friendlier and friendlier and tinier and seems to be invisible is maybe allowing people to not to be hypnotized by the major media as they were in the 20th century. So they start walking down the street again while on the phone. Yeah, I mean they meet in cafes, but they got to answer their cell phones every 2 minutes.
Right, but also in those cafes and in those meeting places, as they are doing in nightclubs in New York, is that's how they meet each other. Is they email each other across the room.
Right.
Or yeah. they call each other on the cell phone.
So that is the chemical body's needs. What most people think by community, they're really just talking about the chemical body's needs. And the chemical body has to have the chip body to coordinate some satisfactions and retrieve the old chemical body community. And yet they don't look at using this instant messaging as making their life more insecure, because the economy can go anywhere. Your jobs can go anywhere due to chip body speed. So we're always a double-edged sword, and it's just the technology simulated, so we're a quadruple-edged sword right now.
And you can email us with comments or questions at live@buildingorganicbodies.com. That's live@buildingorganicbodies.com. We have any emails there coming in?
No emails yet.
I mean, I just marvel at airports. Just think of all the planes that are flying all over the world. And at least a TV body never reports any crashes. Maybe there are and it's covered up. But look at the expertise, the fine sense of community that the air traffic controllers have created by allowing such safety in so many flights.
And yet that's the most highly stressed job of just about any job.
Yeah, that's true. And so they're the saints. They sacrifice their personal health to allow you to have a vacation in the Bahamas, you know.
So they need heart math. They
yes,
need to be breathing through their heart.
Yeah, so the corporations more and more will rely on these, what were very esoteric, secret forms of health, just to survive, just to keep the chemical body going, and I would say that's where it's a renaissance for the astral body. These kind of studies of the heart energies is what I call the astral body, the invisible connections between people. The unseen, what used to be called mystical. You know what I'm saying?
And with that, we're going to take Bob, you've been a record last word on everything tonight.
Sorry.
Moving right along. No, it's okay. you're talking fast tonight. Stay with us here, homegrownradio.nj.com. You know, we had a little, I had an email come across my my screen the other day, and I emailed it on to Carolyn and Bob, and I emailed it to some other people, and it seems that everybody's gotten it, and it's about things we used to do when we were young that are really a no-no today. So we thought we'd kind of go through it, because it feeds into what we were just talking about in the feelings of sense of security. So who wants to start with it?
Yeah, I got it here. It starts with, to all the kids who survived the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the first one, mine came with pictures, the one you sent me. It didn't have the pictures anymore. But it says, first we survived being born to mothers who smoked and or drank while they carried us. And now we know that mothers, the studies have been done to show that if you smoke and drink, you have smaller babies.
But they don't say that line.
No, I'm giving my comment right away here.
Yeah.
That now, that doesn't mean everybody, so that some people got away with it and some people didn't. Number two, they took aspirin, or our generation took aspirin, ate blue cheese dressing, tuna from a can, and didn't get treated for diabetes.
Get tested
for diabetes. So now, what are they saying? That those things in their tuna now has mercury. Everybody's getting tested for diabetes. And, well, you know, people are taking aspirin now as well, so I don't get that one. Do you get it?
No, carry on.
Then after that trauma, our baby cribs were covered with bright-colored lead-based paints. So, okay, that... probably in pregnancy, women weren't supposed to take aspirin, whatever. Lead-based paints, yes, everybody's crib was painted with that, and now we know that lead is no good for us. We had no childproof lids on medicine bottles, doors, or cabinets, and when we rode our bikes, we had no helmets, not to mention the risk we took hitchhiking. So that's all true. But the first ones here, they're trying to say that... people smoked and drank and ate mercury in their tuna, and kids had lead-based paint. But I would say, yeah, well, that's caused so many of us and so many of our children to be affected. You know, we have much more illness now, so I don't think they're making a point that I would agree with there. So after no helmets and hitchhiking, as children, we would ride in cars with no seatbelts or airbags, yes. Riding in the back of a pickup on a warm day was always a special treat. And, of course, that's very dangerous, we're saying now.
So basically, they're speaking to the people who did manage to survive all of that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not speaking to those who did not manage to survive all
of
that.
Right, who got thrown out of a car through the windshield because they didn't have a seatbelt. We drank water from a garden hose and not from a bottle. Well, now all the water's chlorinated and fluoridated, and it wasn't so much then, and we've made our water so contaminated we have to drink from a bottle, but then the bottle has plastic and chemicals leach into the water, so it's just as bad.
But they're saying that it was bad from a garden hose.
Well, they're saying we did it then, and it didn't harm us, and why?
No, we're survivors. They're saying everything you would say, and yet we survived it.
I don't know. Let's go on. We shared one soft drink with four friends from one bottle, and no one actually died from this. So everybody's saying now, don't spread germs. And that's true from the time of kindergarten, because we force all these kids together in kindergarten, and their immune systems are weakened because they're eating so much sugar, they get sicker faster. When we were kids, we didn't get as sick.
So she is saying here, or he is saying, that we survived the dangerous passing of the bottle. You're saying there's more dangers for the 80s, 90s, and aughts kids.
Yeah, I think there are. So let's continue and see. The message, we ate cupcakes, white bread, and real butter, and drank soda pop with sugar in it, but we weren't overweight because we were always playing outside. So they're
flipping. That's not surviving. That's an advantage. So, no, they're saying that stuff is bad, but we're outside playing. Now, you would agree with that. The kids are inside. They get sick sooner.
Yeah. And real butter, actually, we know now that real butter is better than margarine anyway, so they haven't got that straight.
Right. They're mixing it up here.
Mixing it up. Half-truths and half-untruths makes it difficult to comment.
But it appeals to the common confusion. That's what
yeah, and if it's a joke, then, you know, we're trying to take it too seriously. But then they say, we would leave home in the morning and play all day as long as we were back when the streetlights came on. And that was my case when I was a kid. How about you guys?
Yes, that was my kid if I ever was a kid.
No one was able to reach us all day, and we were okay.
And we were fine, and we were off doing our own thing.
Okay, yeah. Now if they're saying that we survived, they're saying, well, the danger, it was really dangerous back then, and we didn't realize it.
Or it's more dangerous now, and that's why kids aren't allowed to do this.
Right, but they're saying we survived this. This is the punchline. We're great survivors.
Kind of. It's trying to mock all the tight, stringent rules on people these days, the way they corral their kids in New York. Yeah, you know, kids can be kidnapped or this and that, but you see parents walking with their children or the nannies walking with their children. You never see a child alone.
So what? This thing is going to congratulate if you're a survivor, but in some half of it is, it was easy to survive back then.
Yeah.
The other half is, no, it was pretty dangerous back there. But then again, you know, the chip body made community very dangerous. They didn't have a chip body.
We would spend hours building our go-karts out of scraps and then ride down the hill, and we'd just find out we forgot the brakes. After running into the bushes a few times, we learned to solve the problem. We did not have PlayStations, Nintendo, Xboxes, no video games at all. No 99 channels on cable, no videotape movies, no surround sound, no cell phones, personal computers, internet, or internet chat rooms. We had friends, and we went outside and found them. We fell out of trees, got cut, broke bones and teeth, and there were no lawsuits from these accidents. We ate worms and mud pies made from dirt, and the worms did not live in us forever. And on and on. We get BB guns, riding bikes.
Said the one about the BB gun. I think they're pretty funny.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I laughed so hard reading this thing.
Yeah. Little League had tryouts, and not everyone made the team. Those who didn't had to learn to deal with disappointment. Imagine that. Yeah, because now they're saying everybody should play or whatever.
No losers.
The idea of a parent bailing us out if we broke the law was unheard of. They actually sided with the law. This generation has produced some of the best risk-takers, problem-solvers, and inventors ever.
They mean the generation of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
Right.
The past 50 years has been an explosion of innovation and new ideas. We had freedom, failure, success, and responsibility, and we learned how to deal with it all.
Not true.
And you were one of them. Congratulations. And then they say to share it with
here's the point.
Others.
They say you might want to share this with others who have had the luck to grow up as kids before the lawyers and the government regulated our lives for our own good. The big flaw here is that it was the people who were born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s who are the lawyers and the government who regulated our lives. So it's a fie on these survivors. They should have all been killed off because they survived to make a terrible world for their kids.
Yeah.
So this is really riddled with confusion, this statement. And it says, while you're at it, forward it to your kids so they'll know how brave their parents were. Well, wait a minute. The kids are rebelling because their parents created a crummy world. When are the baby boomers going to take responsibility for the crap they've done?
No. They're off in the retirement villages, the golden villages now, or traveling the world now that they have time to do so. And they don't really care, Bob.
Yeah, they're even more irresponsible. They never cared ever. I mean, therefore, there was no baby boomer generation. There was just great meme images that the flesh body that was born in the baby boomer years, the flesh body had no say in anything, continues to say it had no say in anything, and yet can be celebrated itself by watching images of itself in the various media, pretending that that was them, but it wasn't them. It was just the images of you translated through all the different TV and chip bodies, and that unawareness is the curse of the baby boomers. I mean, this email really shows you the confusion. This is a baby boomer off in Florida resort.
I know.
Nostalgia for their past, remembering the good things, trying to lash out on all the kids walking down the street, celebrate what she was, and not notice what she made the world into, or he did. Oh, man.
I thought they left out one of the most important ones, and that is that we ran behind the mosquito trucks, right, throwing off the DDT, and some of us survived. Or it's still showing up in many, you know?
Yeah, the cancer and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, this email is a syndrome of the attitude in those retreats or those retirement homes and those people on their luxury cruises going around the world not caring. They're talking about how great they were. What did Garrett used to say? We're talking about when women had children, when wives had lovers, when the trees had grass to grow. You remember that line?
Mm-hmm. From what?
That's a personal. That's a personal friend of mine. Yeah, oh. It's great. Great line.
It's like older people sitting around any time going, you know, those whippersnappers, they don't know what they're doing today. I mean, I remember back when I had to walk 3 miles in the snow. We heard that one.
Yeah, well, this is an update. And what's interesting is they're inventorying all the things that people had in the 20th century that were nowhere near the content of someone in the 19th or 18th century. So this email shows you the many bodies you have. It's an inventory of all the different effects and all the different bodies.
And they all survived.
Well, they were all created by what was going on. This inventory, people just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. And it is very confusing because there are, you know, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And this goes back to what we began with, is that people are anxious because there is no standard reference point for what is where you're living. What is your security? Who's your daddy? You remember, someone pointed this out to me this week, that, you know, in the baseball games, when they want to insult the other team, they go, "Who's your daddy?" Now, this may be just a particular New York Yankees thing, but it implies that certain people don't know who the real father is. But who's your daddy is an icon for the problem on the collective definition of where we're at. Nobody knows who their daddy is. I mean, collectively, what is your protection now?
Well, yeah, the government is trying to be that. And the governments that, Republican governments down here and up in Canada, the Liberal governments, they keep saying they don't want to be in people's houses, their bedrooms, their lives.
For security.
Yeah, so now the Republican Party is supposed to be not involved with people's lives, but this is the party that has Homeland Security.
But
I don't think it's the government that's trying to be your daddy. I think it's the corporations that have staked their claim on that territory.
Right. Now, see, when you get this post-chip body flux, the chemical body and its institutions, the astral body and its institutions, and the TV body and the chip body are all fighting over to be who the daddy is, and they're stumbling over flesh, through flesh, invading, because it's none of them can offer that role to cover the other bodies. So it's all inferior. I mean, this is way beyond the age of terror. We're lucky to even admit we're still alive. I mean, that's an illusion to admit you're alive, that you're still here. That's where you've got to begin to deal with. You've already been killed in any human form. It's not at all like anybody when we had life. This is what this email is implying. These kids don't have a life. So we don't have a chemical body life anymore. And that's why when you watch the media, and this is my solution, don't assume it's talking to you. The media is not talking to you. That's the problem Carol's got to deal with when she goes to government. Oh, there's supposed to be a government here? It turns out there isn't any government there. There's a bunch of people on their Blackberries trying to save themselves, find their daddy, which is usually investment. Grants. That is, you know, the Bible really failed here. The Bible is the last nostalgic item that says the apocalypse is coming. We're way beyond any apocalypse described in the Bible. way beyond in the Armageddon. We've gone, and we're waiting for Daddy to come back. That'd be the reason why popular religion, fundamentalist religion, takes over. Everybody instinctively understands they're not here anymore, and they're dead, so they're trying to figure out when the second coming's going to happen, in what form, and which religion.
So we're imagining aliens.
Yes.
There's your daddy.
Yeah, that some people think the aliens will be their daddy. So we're actually replaying memes of cultural daddyism. All the different cultures, this is Joseph Campbell's myths, you could say those are collections of daddy.
Yeah, Joseph was just looking for his daddy.
Beg your pardon?
Joseph was just looking for his daddy.
Yes, and he was showing how all the old cultures were doing it. So you have the Sopranos. That is showing even the old urban daddy, the mafia, isn't even secure anymore. That's the meaning of the Sopranos. That the hidden ground of protection in 20th century urban life was the mafia, that they're suffering too. So, you know, there's nothing you can look at to get an image of how bad it is. You have to begin to say, I'm not here and the media's not talking to me. So how am I going to survive? What will I do? I'll pretend I'm doing this. I'm going to study heart masking. I'm going to do some research on the heart that doesn't exist anymore. And you send out self to a few corporations, but on the bigger level, how big is the community? There's no security. No security at all. It's over. Gone. You're dead.
Okay, well, hold on, Bob, because that's, you know...
I'm not holding on. That's my...
Slow down. Stop walking up and down the hallway.
I have been sitting for 10 minutes. Anybody who's been noticing me breathing hard is because I've been pacing for an hour and a half, but I've been sitting for 10 minutes of proof that my pacing does not make me talk fast.
Then you just talk fast anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So, Bob, we're still dealing with, you know, our chemical body. You know, Carolyn gives that kind of nervous little laugh there that it's like, what, you know, you're off into a whole other realm of make-believe. You're the one who's looking for your daddy out there in the make-believe world of we are all dead.
Oh, no, we don't get to the accusation zone.
The only way to slow you down, yes,
I'm
really.
Talking about
the last
security.
5 minutes.
I'm talking about security is communication. People are held by the media communication society uses. There is no common form of communication now. That's the point. So your bodies can still be here, your chemical body, but your form of communication is gone, dead, kaput.
Okay, so give us the solution.
Begin to meditate on that. On that fact. Don't meditate on any of the other images. Meditate on the fact that you are already dead in all forms of communication. And then what does that make you want to do? And study the reactions you get from really confronting that full point. And then walk very carefully and smile at everybody you see.
Smile.
And breathe from your heart.
Yeah, and beat from your heart.
There you go.
And there you go. You will go. Basically, remain invisible as much as possible. Now, mostly you can't because you got to show up at work. You got to participate inside the machines. Therefore, use steal softly through snow, as Captain Beefheart said. Steal very softly through the snow, quiet environment already.
So for Carolyn to deal in these corporate environments with their BlackBerries, then she really needs to have a BlackBerry to be emailing them.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know?
I needed to communicate to them that way because that is what's capturing their attention
right.
At this point in their careers and their lives. That's more important to them than the person sitting in front of them.
Because that's the latest medium of communication.
Right.
But the other thing about that is they probably already have their solution to the problem that I see. They have their answer. They don't care what I say. They're just going through the motions.
Yeah.
Of listening to me.
They don't represent chemical body communities as the government's supposed to have done. That's the point.
But they have no power. You know? I mean, you deal with people who really don't have any power, and they know it. They can't make those changes.
Unless they align themselves where the power is, which is a drug company. The
right.
Drug company's told them how to respond.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have any power. I mean, they're useless.
In terms of communication, and communication is affecting your environment. That's what I mean when you're dead. You do not affect your environment anymore. The environment is affected by some other strange collaboration of, I don't want to say machines, because they're very human-friendly machines. They're useful, like the Internet. So it's very hard to name the enemy today. It's too easy to say it's terrorists.
Well, and that's why perhaps the government has created the Homeland Security to pretend there is an enemy, because we don't have Russia anymore, we don't have communists. So now we have terrorists so that we can focus everything on the terrorists.
And create a sense of security. I mean, one of my sources said that in New York City, anytime they had those alerts and people had traffic jams and they had to be careful and every car was checked going over the George Washington Bridge, that that gave people a sense of security. The inconvenience of the traffic jam was overridden by a sense, oh, someone's looking out for us. And that was the reason for the alerts.
Mm-hmm.
So people have a strange response to in this new anxiety of what is security. And so all the governments are trying different strategies. And if a journalist comes along and says, well, there hasn't been any dangerous threats. It's an illusion. There were no terrorists. They're citing evidence from 3 years ago. You know, there was a recent article on that. That misses the point. It's all the machines showing that they're involved with you.
And well, terrorism is one clear example of our inability to communicate.
Yes, yeah.
Well, what Paul says in his email, communication is dead. It doesn't work if you look at the world as a giant supercomputer.
Right. It's a tiny computer, a tiny virus.
What is?
Whatever he's saying, it doesn't work to look at as a big computer. So ask him to email, what is he referring to? I assumed I knew.
He says communication is dead. Doesn't work if you look at the world as a giant supercomputer. So you're saying the world is not a giant supercomputer?
Yes, I'm saying that, and I'm saying communication is still dead. He's saying communication doesn't work if you look at it as a big computer. I'm saying it doesn't work if it's a little computer,
mm-hmm.
a little user-friendly computer. It's even more insidious because it makes you think that it is there for you. That's demographic. That's customized services. Yet you try to, any of those services go amok, then you try to find out where the problem is, where it came from. You're not going to find it. And that's why people salute and go to mall religions and show up and work and don't say a word and don't care that Bush lied to them. You know, the presidency is always the news, the art form, the ultimate movie, the ultimate gallery. It tells you what's going on. And all that we've described is perfectly masked by a president who doesn't communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't even care that he lies, if he apparently lies. But journalists say he lied, if you go back to what he said before, but they're silly. They try to match what he said 2 weeks ago to what he's saying today. That's not his job. His job is to continue reaffirming that there's no communication. And that's a secure image for people. Because they're up against the TV body, which has been proven to be not a very good communicator over the last 40 years.
Okay. Well, it's made people a lot of money. It's pushed the content around the world. It's created content.
Yes, but
for our various bodies.
And obsolesce a sense of community to the point that France feels threatened by those American images and are upsetting the plans for a united European market.
Well, the European market has kind of been going strong for the past decade, and
yes.
I remember you saying a while back that every 10 years people go through the opposite. So it's like the rulers, the technocrats, and bureaucrats who want to create this world government and make everything harmonized and standardized and everything in control, they don't realize that the public is going to rebel every 10 years and want to do the opposite.
Yeah, now what's interesting is that when you went to Bern or Bonn, you felt that these guys were so out of touch, they were on an agenda to start 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and just going along. That's another reason there's no communication. Old bureaucracies know that you ignore the audience's shifts in mood, and you just keep plodding along, pretending you're doing something. And those guys will plod along, and eventually in 50 years, people will want the harmonization, or it'll already be implemented. But the public had no say in it.
Right, it's like with GM Foods, we've been talking about this over the various shows, that they just grow them anyway, and they'll be imploded into our food chain, and people are saying that, what is the figure, Celia, about 40% of our soy is already GM?
45% of our corn, I think, and in the 60% of our soy.
Right. So that's mostly without our knowledge or without our consent, that most of the population is probably eating GM right now. And what the corporations start to say at a certain point is, well, look, everybody's eating it, and it's not affecting anyone. And how do they know that? Just because people's heads don't explode when they eat a GM meal, they think it's okay.
And that's why they got to give Gina Jolie and these J-Lo and Julie Roberts $50 million a movie, because they are the important community agents to distract everybody from the fact that machines and their bureaucracies aren't talking to each other. That's why the banal rules. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And it's the only coherency.
And so our listening audience can meditate, ruminate on all those points as we come to the top of the hour. It is 9 o'clock, and I want to thank you, Dr. Dean, and Bob Neverett, for being with me here on Building Organic Bodies on homegrownradionj.com.
And we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
No problem. And so as far as we know, we'll see. We'll be back here next week, same time, same station. And y'all have a wonderful Memorial weekend. Drive carefully. Bye-bye for now.